Mr. Emery, Reel 9. You were talking about the way the Americans treated the German prisoner of war.
They were awed, and I thought, well, that could be my grandfather, you know. And I didn't. Whatever the Germans did, I suppose a percentage of them did it, but not every German was the same, put it that way. I expect there was good ones as well as bad ones. Anyway, he said, we shan't be doing that. That's so anyway, we moved down and took over. About 9,000 prisoners there.
And the camp was actually called?
Stimuli Lager.
Stimuli.
S-T-A-M-U-I-L-H-E, something like that.
U-I-L-H-E.
Stimuli Lager, near Senne Lager it was. About 9,000 prisoners there. About three compounds of men. Was it two or three compounds of men and one? About 250 SS women. It was in a separate compound. Used to lie there in the sun, stripped to the waist and upset all the blokes that it was marching by, you know, behind the bar, because it was barbed wire all the way around. But they were treated badly there. They used to get about five or seven a day die there, because a lot of old men there. There's also German troops there and officers that were being tried by the War Crimes Tribunal. Right opposite RHQ there, we had to move out the barracks because the barracks was lousy. We were lying in the barracks and it was whatever, bed bugs or whatever was dropping off the walls, so we had to move out and sleep in other places there. Well, so, but right opposite RHQ, there was a condemned cell there. I always remember outside there was a flowering cherry. Well, it was all out in lovely pink blossom right by this window. And inside, I always remember in that condemned cell, looking out the window, was this German officer. And he looked a German officer, but he was in there waiting until the Americans used to take him away and shoot him. You know, the colonel said, we're not guarding them and shooting them. So when he were found guilty, he was sentenced to death. Then Americans would pick him up and deal with it. But we used to draw working parties there. I drew two German soldiers, tall and short, both speak English. And they used to take them around, march them around there. I said, oh, don't worry about Jeeps. We know about it, iron them there. We had a lot of British equipment. And they go far better than I could with their maintenance. They do all the maintenance work. And if there was any spare bread or things like that, there's that sausage left that people was going to throw in the swill bin. I used to whip it up into it, and they scoffed that back because they were starved there. And I got on quite well. When I went on leave from there, these two same blokes cut a great big hole in the barbed where the bloke was watching him and done a bunk. They never caught him up to him. He got shivs. So I was all right. He was in the apple car. But at the same time, outside the dining hall there was a swill bin, 45-gallon drum. You just go out there and you know what? Well, in them days, it was the smoke. Cigarette butts on there with a bit of dry bread in their teeth, all in the swill bin, slops out the swill bin. And used to draw two German soldiers to work in the cookhouse, and they be stood to attention outside of the mess up until the cooks called them. As soon as he said right, they used to dive in that swill bin and scrape out anything that was edible. That was white men, you know. I thought, well, perhaps I could understand African countries do when they're short of food, but there, when you think, seeing white men in it, they used to dive in there and they take anything that was out, you know, was filling with tea leaves and all that sort of business. But we used to collect from the dairy. I'd go around the dairy, it was about 5 miles away, and collect seven big urns of milk from the dairy to distribute round. They used to get 2 meals a day, black soup and black bread in the morning, soup and black bread at night, and whatever the milk was, seven urns of milk between 9,000 prisoners in the lot. So I went round the dairy, I had this job for a week, went round the dairy, and out come this woman, quite attractive woman actually, about in her 30s. She said, my father's in Stimuli, in whichever lager three. She said, we have the seven churns of milk here. She had this eighth churn in there. She had eggs and butter and bread. She said, that goes into, you take it in from my father. She said, you do that. She said, every day I was to get half a dozen eggs, and half a pound of unsalted butter. Oh, lovely. I was egg bound. Everybody had eggs all round our hut. So we used to go there every day, round us. Never went in, just drove to the gates, they'd unlock the gates, the cars, and out come the capo, always a big German, broke nose one. It looked, everybody else, he'd beat anybody to death. He used to come out and draw. Whether her father ever got any of these rations, I don't know. But anyway, I'd done this for a week, and then I went on leave. Came home on leave. While I was home on leave, the next bloke was doing, she was lushing him up with the eggs, and whatnot else, and he got caught on a charge. I don't know if he got 14 days CB or something, loss of leave and whatnot else. Well, I was lucky I got away with it. But but they were dying there quite, they were old, a lot of them, perhaps they died at home, I don't know. But there was a lot of unnecessary prisoners there. There'd be a big sick parade every day. With our MO and the German MO used to be there, and the German MO used to listen to the sick parade talking and hear them soaring, breaking out of compound three the night or something. There's a couple of them that know what used to talk amongst themselves. He used to shot them to the British, and out they'd break out of the compound. There'd be six or seven troops waiting for them, and that one straight back inside, sort of business again. So we were there then, August. I think that's been about a month here, I don't know.
July to August, or?
Yeah, about July to August, before the atom bomb was dropped. Anyway, we left. We moved down to Belgium then to go to America in the Empire Corps for the invasion of Japan. Again, I was on the advance part. We moved to, where do we go to? St. Maria Oderhove, I always remember. St. Maria, little Belgian town. We were billeted all around there. But I went to Brussels on the advance party, fly back to England, and then we were going, I think it was a queue of Queen Mary, because he used them as troop ships, straight to America, where we were going to get all American equipment and train there for the invasion of Japan. Oh, it was all for, we thought we were going to give the Yankee women all what the Yanks had been given earlier, all the high chat and whatnot else. When we got. Anyway, they dropped the first atom bomb, and it got cancelled, they sued for peace, so that invasion of Japan fell by the board. So back to St. Maria Oderhove again, and we moved from there. I was billeted with a Belgian family there. They used to write to me. I had three girls and a boy. I still got letters out there. What he wrote to me, I sent them oranges from Palestine and all for the kids, you know. Anyway, we moved from there and we went to Middelkerk on the Belgian coast, not far from Ostend. I was just boarding houses there, sleeping on the floor as usual. And it was decided then that we were going to the Middle East as a part of the strategic reserve. So again, back down to Brussels, I went on the advance party. Full kit, plus water bottle, rifle, bayonet, yaw, all that lot. And it flew out to Egypt and converted.
Now, when was this?
This was end of September, beginning of October. By then, I should say, Colonel Teacher had left and gone back to Catterick Camp. And Major Dixon, who was the second in command, took charge for about 6 weeks.
What was Major Dixon like?
Well, I'm saying nothing. Well, he didn't like me, put it that way. So,
why didn't he like you?
Well, I don't know. You can't like everybody, can you? That was him who was in charge when we were in Normandy on the concentration area. Anyway, he took charge, and then we had Colonel, what was the last one? Colonel Edmees come just before going to the Middle East.
What was he like?
Liverish. A bit of a liverish sort of a man. He was a regular serving officer. He finished up Garrison Commander. I saw in the Soldier magazine years after he was Garrison Commander down at Plymouth. That's where he finished up, as far as I know. But anyway, so on the advance party, down to Brussels again, converted Lancaster bombers, loaded up at 3 o'clock in the morning, seats, one blanket to wrap around your legs, no heat, as usual. Took off at 3, flew over the Alps, perishing cold with a blanket wrapped around you, across the Mediterranean, landed at Castel Bonito in Tripoli at 10 o'clock. I always remember that. First time I'd ever been up in the plane, this was. I'd never been there. And looking out the window, seen the watch the gradually little small squares be getting bigger and bigger on the runway and landed. Landed there, there was something wrong with the plane, our plane, so we were delayed there. So we went in the mess hall, and it was like being in a luxury hotel. It was all Italian prisoners of war waiting on us. So we had an afternoon in the tents there. I slept, got bit on the neck by a bull ant. And I had both visions of dinosaurs. Never seen a bull ant before because they're quite large. And we loaded up at 6 o'clock at night for the second leg, this was. So we left at 3 o'clock in the morning. This was 6 o'clock next night. Left at 6 o'clock, Casta Bonita, to fly to Cairo. Well, this time we had to change the seats around. Going out the first half, I had a seat by down the side of the plane, but the second half, there was 8 of us sat up in the wing where the wings joined on. There was 4 sat there, 4 sat there. All you could do was look at his face there with your rifle stuck between your legs there. And we got to Cairo, 6 hours on that set there, all with your brown paper bags in case you were airsick. All had a brown paper bag apiece. So we get to Cairo, and you hear the wheels go down, clunk, clunk. And comes in the land, and sat right over the wheels as well. He misjudged it. He hit the deck there, bang, and he must have leapt about 10 feet in the air and bounced off. I'd never seen so many big saucer dogs. Anyway, he was decent enough. He come back and apologized. He said, sorry, lads. He said, I misjudged it. But he went leaping all down, Christ, frightened all us to death. So we went from there then up to, had a meal in the mess hall, and it was getting light then. And that's when I saw the pyramids and the Sphinx. You could see that in the distance. We went from there then up to Kassassin, or Kassassin, Q-U-A-S-S-I-N or something. A camp up there, and it was not built under canvas. So, as I said, it was on the advance party. So the first morning up there, along come about 12 Egyptian trucks, 3-tonners, with Egyptian drivers. And each one of us had to get in the back with our rifle and went down to the POW camp and drew so many German prisoners, ex-Africa Corps. I got you, and it was smart. All stripped to the waist, brown as berries, had their little grey shorts and their Africa Corps caps on. And he was smart. He marched them all out. That I write every call field, blah, blah, blah. He marched them all out, split them all up to, got them in. And I was stood in the back, me with a rifle, jammed in with these 30 German. They could have murdered me. It was a waste of time. And drove back to Kassassin. So gets out the truck. I'm still in KD, battle dress then, because you'd never had KD. Still in battle dress, and the sergeant major comes over to me. He says, you go and sit in the shade. Soldier, he said, I'll deal with these. He gave them all their orders, and he had that camp up in no time. It's discipline then, as though it was, you know, they were still, and they had it all up. And I felt mean because cigarettes they wanted, and I didn't smoke. I never carried any. You know, I never, and I would have given them 50 cigarettes for, because he said, you sit in the shade. Anyway, got talking to them then. Most of them could speak English. Most of them were friendly. He wanted to know all about Germany. Where have you been? Hamburg and all. What's it like? I was honest with him. I said, well, Hamburg, nothing left there. But he'd been all round Blankenburg and Middelkirk, where we'd been in Belgium. They'd been on stationed 1941 in Normandy and all. But it was almost like he was talking to all comrades sort of business. Anyway, they erected that tent, that camp, and was gone, and marched them all back, split them up in the trucks. They went, I need to have been there. It was well, but he hadn't, some of them hadn't been home since 1941, you know, since 1945 then. So the regiment arrived then, gradually, bit by bit. I got sent down with the staff car down again. Me, I don't know, must have been something about me either. He didn't like me. I thought I was the best, one of the two, but I got sent down to Cairo to pick up the colonel. All the way down the Sweetwater Canal, through the back streets of Cairo, and the colonel arrived about 12 or 1 o'clock. I'm out to come straight back. I'd been up all blasted day, and driving back at night. So I knew a way across, I knew a shortcut across the desert then. Instead of going all the way up there and down there to get to Kassassin, I knew if I branched off, hopefully I was right, and cut across. I see myself about 8, 10, 12 miles. I went out. So anyway, going up the Sweetwater Canal again, he was sat in the back with second in command and the adjutant. So I straight off the road. Where are you going, soldier? What you know? What on the bloody hell are you doing? No, I said, oh, no, my way, sir. Open. I was right, but anyway, I was right. And when he got out of the car, he graciously said, thank you very much. That was Colonel Edmeats. So we stayed at Cassis in there, got acclimatized, got issued with our KD and all things like shorts. And
did you find it difficult to acclimatize?
No, well, it was autumn, wasn't it? You know, it wasn't really summer. It was nice, warm, comfortable.
It was around Octoberish.
Yeah, October, see. Yeah, we were there, I don't know, perhaps 3 weeks. Across 2 or 3 miles away over there, there was another camp, and that was the King's Royal Africa Rifle Corps, King's African Rifle Corps or something. And every morning at 6 o'clock, they'd have their early morning parade, bugle band. It used to be lovely. You could hear them playing the old drum, and they'd have about hours drill and marching. And I don't know what he did after, but I got talking to one. I was there on duty at night and was talking to one of them. He come out. He said, "There's all very well for you English, all you English going home." He said, "But 3 boats to take English, only 1 boat to take us home." They were in a transport corps that had served in Italy and all that. But he said, "Listen." I said, "What?" He said, "Somebody coming." I couldn't hear anybody. I said, "Where?" He said, "There." And he crouched down, and about 2 minutes later, out of the dark, come this other African from the camp. Yeah, I couldn't blast it here. So we moved from there then down to El Bala on the Suez Canal.
El
Bala. B-A-L-L-A-H. Moved on camp there. That was all sunken pits there, I suppose, from during the war. That was a camp we had to make up ourselves there. All the pits were filled with sand, so we had to dig all the pits out and erect a tent. I went swimming in the Suez Canal there. When I was on the advance party, he used to take the officer around in the jeep. He said, "Right, drop me at the officer's naffy on the Suez Canal, give me 2 shillings. He said, "Go and get your dinner and pick me up." So you could park your jeep there and get your eggs in bread, whatever it was. And I was swimming in the Suez Canal, you see. Take all your clothes, always no women about there. I started swimming up from east to west, or north, no, from south to north up the Suez Canal. Coming this big troop ship, miles away it seemed to me, about 90 yards wide in the Suez Canal or something, and I'm swimming across. All of a sudden his sirens going, Christ, when I looked around, I thought you were going to run me down. I had to go like the clappers to get out the other, just crawl. But they were all people coming back from the Far East, shouting out, "Get your knees brown," as they went by, you know. And so at El Bala there, then that was in November, I got sent on a fortnight's meet again, on an anti-rock course down to Abukir, down near Alexandria. Only me from the regiment.
What were you learning?
Anti-rock course, how to deal with, obviously I didn't rioters in this way, that's all I was taught, was anti-rock course. So off I went, usual kit and all that, rifle, on the Egyptian train, only me, all blacks on there are Egyptians, and I wanted to go to the toilet. I was afraid to leave my kit there in the train and go to the toilet. It was right down the end of the other car, so I had to lump it all down the toilet, rifle and all. And I went down anyway, and eventually got to Alexandria. I had to change it, Zagazig, I think it was. And,
what was the course like?
Well, it was first thing in the morning out with the old tree trunks, shorts, you know, and then teaching you how to deal with rioting.
What did they teach?
Well, I'm coming to that now. He said, right, now, after your PT, right out there, just plimsolls and shorts, nothing else. And you got there all lined up, and I think about 16 or 18 of us on this course, all from different regiments, from 3rd Div. Royal Ulster Rifles, Lincolnshire Regiment, it was in the same tent as me. Said, now pick up as many stones as you like, and the sergeant's going to come up over that ridge there and start calling all the names under the sun. And you can throw as many stones at him as you like. Chase him up there. Right, it was a PT sergeant or something. So we had all these small stones. He'd come over, no rabble and whatnot. I was never seen a shower at all. So we all rushes towards him, starts throwing the stones, and he gets up on the stones, are getting closer, and he disappears over the ridge, the other side. We get up on the top of the ridge, and they had 2 fire hydrants down the other side, on full blast, didn't they? Because we bought us all over in no time. Said, that's the way to deal with rioters. You know, that was one of the things they taught us. Also advancing down with your rifles, you know, in the line and all that, to quite a crowd. I can't remember much else about it. It was the Armistice State Service there when we were there, which we went to the church, and I came back out of the fort. I couldn't tell you. It was a deal mostly with rotting in physical fitness anyway. We had a hell of a load of PT, especially with the old tree trunks, you know, throwing them at one another and all that sort of business. So I came back the same way, zag and zig, back to El Bala. I get back to El Bala, which was a little hut by the railway line on the Suez Canal, which was about 4 miles from camp, as far as I know. I'm saying, you never went out of camp anyway when you were there, so you didn't say, well, you went here and turned down there. All I know, the coastal road, the canal road went that way. Turn left or turn right and go down the road that way, right down the end, and then turn right again and come back to the camp we were at. So this was 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, pitch dark. Nobody had to pick me up. So I got my kit bag, all my kit, my rifle, and I starts off, walks along the road, eventually comes to the right turn, goes down there, comes to another camp there, British Army camp, stops, all who goes there, stops. I say, is there any chance of getting a lift round? I can't remember what the camp number was. I'll have to see the guard commander. So goes down, fetch it out, the sergeant. No, I'm sorry. I said, well, no chance of a lift at all. So I said, smart round, no, you won't get a lift here. And the duty officer's in bed now. I can't wake him. There's always no hope. So anyway, I carried on down the road. I thought, Christ, this is going on for you. So I thought, well, the camp's that way across the desert. Angle of 45 degrees. So I cut across the desert and eventually bumped into the perimeter, which is like a POW camp, into the perimeter fence, and followed it all the way. Got back about 1:30 in the morning. So that's all I can remember about that. Then we moved. We went to Port Said. They took us as Port Said on a sort of a day out. Well, as the French wouldn't let us in the dance hall. That was officers only. Well, it was a bit of a French town, Port Said anyway, or Port Said, whatever you like to call it. Apartment, that was nothing to do. All I know, it cost me about, I saw an apples there on sale. Oranges, you could get 10 a penny, but I saw an apple there. It cost me about, one apple cost me about 6 months or 9 months, which is a lot of money then, as far as for just one apple. And it didn't taste the same anyway. We went round the bars then, drinking all shorts, whiskey. Used to play a game there, which jacks with cards. First jack turned up, chose to drink. Second jack turned up, got the sip. Third jack that turned up, drank the short. And the fourth jack that turned up, paid. See, well, we used to do that for about four drinks. You know, you could, if you were lucky, you'd get four drinks for nothing. If you were unlucky, you paid for four drinks and got nothing, sort of business. And that was, it was all rot gust stuff. And he said, oh, this is whiskey and that, but I've never seen a whiskey bottle. And I thought, I shouldn't think. It was all that Egyptian stuff. But anyway, we did that all day and came back at night in the truck. And that was the only time I went to Ishmaelia. They didn't want to know you, though. There was all Egyptians. Moasker Barrett was there, but that was ATS and all the permanent staff. Like, it was always men's units where I was. So then we moved up to Palestine then.
And whereabouts to Palestine did you go? So, and when?
Palestine, I think. Before Christmas, anyway.
So December?
Yeah, December sometime, yeah.
And where did you go to?
Camp 71 at Hadera. They've had several bomb attacks out there recently at Hadera. But it used to be a crossroads there. You turn right on the main coastal road. You turn right to go up into Hadera village. You turn left to go down into Camp 71, which was a bit like a POW camp. Lots of barbed wire surrounding it. And on the corner of the crossroads is a Palestine police station, which was more like a French Foreign Legion fort used to be, like there, which was a British policeman, Egyptian, Arab policeman, and Jewish policeman.
Now, what was going on in Palestine? Were you aware of this?
Yeah, there was all this trouble starting. So I'll get to that now. So we went to Camp 71. It was a terrible place, really. Had a picture house there, which used to show pictures twice a week, a nafe, and nothing else. They did all the cross country there. But the Palestine police used to, we had a, there was also a Coast Guard station on the Coast Guard, give it Olga. And the Palestine police used to go out there during the day, and the 112 like that cat used to take over at night and up there and guard. So we always had a guard at Palestine police station, at the Coast Guard station. Well, that was about 20 or 30 blokes, I suppose, and a couple of wireless operators. They'd be out there all night. When it got light, the Palestine police would come riding on their horses and take over again. We also did 24-hour day patrols, three eight-hour patrols. Used to go from 12 midnight to 8 in the morning, 8 morning to 4 in the afternoon, 4 in the afternoon to 12 midnight. We also had roadblocks out on the, when the curfew started on the road, because there was all sorts of trouble going on. There's arms smuggling. From the Coast Guard station, we had the wireless, so we used to be in touch with the Navy out. We used to have a destroyer up and down looking for illegal ships and things like that. We used to be in touch with them. Also in touch with divisional headquarters. Road patrol, I used to do that 8 hour, sat in the back of a Jeep with a wireless set, just up and down from north as far as Caesarea, and south as far as nearly down to Netanya, which is the Diamond Center. And then we used to go up into the Hadera village itself. But that's what we used to do there. So they blew up the railway line while we were there and robbed the mail train at 35. That was either the Stern Gang or the Ear Gun. There was three lots, Stern Gang, the Ear Gun, and the Haganah was the three. I think the Haganah was the official one. The other two were sort of terrorist groups. Well, they're all terrorist groups when they're fighting against you. When you're fighting for yourself, they're all patriot sort of business. But anyway, they blew up the Coast Guard station and stole £35,000, which is a lot of money in 1946. That was about beginning of January, I think. Also about, I think it was the 13th, 17th of January, the Coast Guard station had been down. The Coast Guard station had been damaged once before, and the Palestine police had got people in to rebuild it. Well, evidently, when they rebuilt it, it was Jewish builders. They built explosives into the base of it on a time fuse, and 364 battery, whatever troop was up there on guard, and the thing went up at quarter. Wrecked them. I got photographs out of a great big chunk of concrete. There was one chap up there, was one chap killed, 17 wounded, I think. The chap that was killed was being demobbed next day, married man with two children. And he needn't have been on that guard, but he did that guard because he wanted to be with his mates. He did his last guard with his mates, you know. And I was like, Charlie, Fred, I'll do my last guard. And I'm just going home next day with demob, and he got killed. And then things got tighter then. It was... you couldn't go out of camp. That was your life in that. You only went out of camp when you were on duty then. As I said, it was 8 hour patrols, 24 hours a day. And I used to do, as a signal, I used to do, say, the 8 to 4 during the day, then have the evening off at night. And then next day I'd do the 4 to 12, and I've done a night off, and then I'd be on sort of training or whatever it was, repairing lines or what other jobs I was to do. Then I'd do the third one, it'd be 12 till 8. Well, I did the 12 till 8 this particular night, and it was, as soon as it got light, we had a big marquee that we erected ourselves. Tent walls ought to be rolled up so the air could get in. I was asleep in my bed there, you know, with all the noise of gun crews training with their bovers trying to sleep. But in the afternoon, it was across country.